This is a coastal story, written and presented by Charlie Connolly. There's something transient about a beach, that no man's land between the shore and the sea, washed over twice a day by the tide, a hinterland, a temporary place where nothing is permanent, always the same, yet never the same. There is a sense of the beach being a kind of halfway house between the limits and routines of normal life and the infinite possibility of the horizon. And we always face the horizon when we settle down on a beach, maybe feeling some primordial pull towards the sea from which we emerged. It's not surprising that, as the fulcrum between our civilized selves and our primitive versions that first crawled tentatively from the water, the beach has come to be a place where normal rules and customs don't seem to apply. On the beach, we're as close to naked as we'll ever be in front of strangers. We give ourselves over to pleasure and self-indulgence. We lounge. We loll. We snooze. We cavort in the waves and behave in ways that we wouldn't dream of behaving if we were standing just a few yards further inland. It's not surprising, then, that the beach has always been a place of concern for those intimidated or appalled by anything short of primly rigid morality. The morality of the seaside has been a point of debate ever since, well, ever since there was a seaside. Take this, for example, from the Imperial Weekly Gazette as long ago as 1819. The frequent complaints which have reached us of the infamous conduct of a set of wretches who infest many of the watering places at length call for notice. It is well known to be a constant practice at watering places to promenade along the sea side, and it is perhaps one of the greatest advantages these places have to boast of. It is now, however, rendered not merely disagreeable, but shocking to the delicacy of females, thanks to the constant habit of a number of beings of the worst description of going into the bathing machine when the promenade is full, and when undressed, quitting them and exposing their persons in the shallow water. At Margate, for instance, those who are walking on the beach cannot see the people who are bathing, so long as the latter keep within the precincts of the machine. But it is the practice of those gentry to leave the boundaries of the machines and advance towards the beach till sometimes the water scarcely covers their knees. From the description given by a gentleman recently returned from Margate, it would appear that these disgraces to manhood consist generally of dandy slop boys from the metropolis, while kindred dandies stand on the beach with a set of liveried lackeys, their friends and associates, to force the attention of the promenaders to them. Half a century later, a Kent newspaper again identified Margate as a hotbed of moral degeneracy, but not before it had fingered another societal development still new in 1856. It was the boast of Englishmen that we were a more moral people than any other, it lamented. The Court of Divorce has unfortunately drawn aside that veil and exposed any number of exceptions. Now that was just a jab. The full-on haymaker was swung at the chin of beach resorts. In these places, no sooner do English ladies and gentlemen arrive than they seem to give up their decorum with their railway or boat ticket. The women were the worst, obviously. At the seaside, their very natures seem to change, and they appear to vie with their daughters to who shall most exceed the bounds of propriety. Take, for example, the case of Margate. This favourite place of Cockney resort is rapidly filling with visitors, and soon scarcely a lodging will be vacant. There, unblushingly, ladies and gentlemen bathe almost indiscriminately, and the distance which separates the gentlemen's bathing machines and the ladies' is more in imagination than reality. The men gambol in the water nearly in nature's garb, and the ladies, although they wear bathing dresses, conduct themselves as if they feel these dresses to be an encumbrance. Ladies do not seem to consider that they outrage decorum by viewing from the pier and the beach, through opera glasses, the antics of nude gentlemen. We are not prudists.
Yes, you are.
And do not profess to be more moral than other people.
Yes, you do.
But must confess that we cannot help blushing at the barefaced conduct of certain portions of our countrywomen. How is it that a lady, modest and retiring in London, becomes brazen and bold at Margate? It is an enigma which we confess we cannot solve. At the end of the century came the development that really saw off the last shred of seaside morality. The penny in the slot machine, and in particular, the mutoscope. When it was introduced to British seasides in the late 1890s, the mutoscope was the first experience most people had of moving pictures. You'd put your penny in the slot, look into the viewfinder, turn the handle, and there in front of you was a scene from a melodrama, or a battleship sailing past, a boxing match perhaps, or a London street scene. Hundreds of photographs flicking past at high speed to give the illusion of movement. This being the seaside, the mutoscope almost immediately became renowned for its more lascivious content. What the butler saw, for example, giving the viewer that illicit thrill of witnessing something they shouldn't, as if quite by chance, peeking through the curtain at just the wrong, or rather just the right, moment. Available to anyone with a penny on promenade or pier, you could view such titillating mise-en-scene as Wiggling Wonders, The Virgin of Baghdad, Beside an Open Fireplace, Bedroom Secrets, and Behind the Blind. It was big business, not least because the presentations were easy to make. At the start of the 20th century, many of the British mutoscope productions seen up and down the country were made by Raymond Jackson, a photographer with a studio in Hove, and starred a local art student who in the space of one afternoon was able to perform in Parisian Can-Can and its sequel, Ooh La La, Nightlife in Gay Paris, spelt P-A-R-E-E, Artist and Model, How to Pose the Naked Truth, A Striptease, and Saucy, Snappy, Scintillating. Not surprisingly, there were letters. One correspondent wrote to the Isle of Wight Observer in 1899, "Dear Sir, I write to you in the hope that you will use your valuable influence against the exhibition of indecent pictures now on view in the penny in the slot machines standing on the pier at Ryde. It is a marvel that the directors, being responsible Christian men and fathers of families, should permit such a pitiful profanation of their beautiful pier, and of a delightful science, as instantaneous photography has now become, by the display of lewd subjects intended to degrade the young and lower their moral status." In Blackpool the same year, a clergyman railed from the pulpit, clutching a letter he'd received that informed him exhibitions of French bathers were flaunted openly in mutoscopes on the streets, turning them into lanes of Sodom. The letter had made him ill, he said, but he vowed to see the material for himself, and after dropping a penny in the slot, looked through the gateway to perdition. The Bishop of London called for the machines to be banned, presumably having also conducted extensive research with a trouser pocket full of pennies. The nation's moral guardians found themselves repeatedly frustrated in their attempts to bring about the downfall of the mutoscope's saucy seaside scenarios. In Hastings in 1901, the Mutoscope Company itself was summoned to court under the Obscene Publication Act, where they were asked to give a reason why certain pictures in their machines should not be destroyed. The company's lawyer informed them that every single title, bar one, The Elopement, was freely available to view in machines across London without fear of prosecution. He admitted that the pictures might be considered objectionable, but they were not, in the legal sense, obscene. And he won. And mutoscopes could be found at the British seaside right up until decimalisation in 1971, when it proved too tricky and costly to convert the machines to accept the new coins. Some mutoscopes were scrapped, others shipped to Denmark, where pornography had just been legalised. It wasn't all naked people, though. In 1902, 3 years after emigrating to Britain from the US, Sir Hiram Maxim, inventor of, among other things, curling tongs, the mousetrap, and the machine gun, was leaving a Brighton hotel with his wife and handed over a cheque to pay his bill. The hotel manager wrung his hands and informed the great innovator that he'd much prefer cash, as he couldn't be certain he had the pleasure of addressing the real Sir Hiram Maxim. At which point, Lady Maxim suggested the manager accompany her to the pier, where she dropped a penny into the slot of a mutoscope, and invited him to crank the handle and see footage of her husband demonstrating a machine gun in the presence of the Shah of Persia. The cheque was graciously accepted, not least because the manager had not only confirmed the inventor's identity, but had observed that he knew his way around a machine gun. That was A Coastal Story. I'm Charlie Connolly. Find us on Twitter at Podcast Coastal, that's at Podcast Coastal, and on Facebook by searching Coastal Stories Podcast. If you've enjoyed this or any other episode, you can, of course, buy Coastal Stories a pint in the link I'll put in the show notes. Any reviews and ratings you can also leave us really helps as well. Coastal Stories is researched, written, presented, and produced by me, Charlie Connolly. See you next time.